Vaughn. Where are we at here? Are we on E or five? Five, I'm sorry. Having a little trouble with my scorecard today. Greg, good morning.
So just real quickly, this is the annual report that we're required by the state of California to produce on the fees and carried interest of all of our private markets investments. This is a statutory requirement. I think over the years, the board has sought to derive some more insights from it, and Greg's going to go over some of the additional appendices that address some of the trustees' questions. But Brian's on the road today, so we're joined by Greg, who works on this very closely, to go over the report and highlight some of the more interesting fees and expenses we see this year.
Yeah, sobering to read that list. Good morning.
Good morning, members of the board. As Tim mentioned, this is the alternative investment fees.
Greg, can you pull that microphone? I don't even know if it's on.
It's not on.
Make sure it's on and then pull it towards you a little bit.
Oh, I need to put it green.
Sorry.
And then and you might want to pull it a little bit towards you. Just want to make sure everybody's hearing you.
Good morning, members of the board. As Tim mentioned, this is the alternative investment fees and expense report for the year of 2024. So there is slight of a lag there. So first, I'll provide a overview or review. I think all of you have seen this once or more before. There are many detailed tables with all of those numbers. So I'll just point out a couple of items there to look at, to see how we review them as the investment office. And then I'll also discuss the appendix exhibits that the board has requested in previous years that has been evolving over time. This is Government Code 7514.7. The main intent there is to increase transparency of public funds cost of private investment vehicles. So that would be private equity, private debt, private real estate, infrastructure, as we've broken it out. So the main disclosure requirements by the code are the fees and expenses that the plan pays directly to the alternative investment vehicle. It's our expenses not included in those that are paid to the investment vehicle from the fund manager or related parties. Three, it's the carried interest, so the incentive pay that we pay managers. Four, it would be the aggregate fees paid by all of the portfolio companies to the fund manager. Any other additional information there. So the columns described in numbers 1 through 5 aren't necessarily in order, there are basically two pages or two tables per asset class, private equity, private credit, and real estate. One talking about the expenses, two, the money that was actually contributed, distributed, and the return characteristics of those funds as of December 2024. And the methodology here is Cicero uses the Institutional Limited Partners Association template to gather this information. So we ask all managers to fill this out, and they usually do on a quarterly basis. So we take the year-end values, and if there's anything that's missing, we speak to them directly. So all the information is from the managers themselves.
Am I correct? And I just can't recall, but the fees that we pay are largely negotiated. That is, when we do a funding commitment, right, to a particular manager, we're able, within some degree of latitude, I don't know how much there is, to actually negotiate fees, right? Is that fair, generally?
You could call it, the traditional model is the 2 and 20, so 2% management fee, 20% incentive.
Okay.
that's the basic that people use. Every fund does it slightly differently. They do also offer some incentives. If you join early, you could get some reprieve or some discounts. And if you join late, then sometimes you have to pay for whoever was already there earlier. So every fund has a different statutory or different contractual rate, and the negotiations are really one by one.
But just put a little more color on that. Our ability to negotiate varies quite significantly across this landscape. If we're talking about growth equity or venture capital, where there's still, despite the last couple of years, a strong demand, you know, the ability to negotiate is a little bit more muted. And so we go to the things that Greg talked about, early commitment, discounts, sometimes of size discounts, that sort of thing. But if we move over to the private credit landscape where we actually have separately managed accounts, those are heavily negotiated. So it kind of depends on our relative importance to the pool of capital. So if somebody's raising a $20 billion private equity fund and we're committing $50 million, something close to rack rate. If we're setting up a separately managed account and our mandate is expressed in it's our investment guidelines, a lot more clarity on our ability to negotiate there. So it's hard to talk about this as a monolith. It varies quite dramatically across the asset classes and within the asset classes as well.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you for that color.
Great, thanks. So the pages of the follow are all those tables. So pages 3 to 6 are the private equity, pages 7, 8 are private credit, and the remainder are, or the next two are real estate. And I do realize that I mislabeled the private credit as private equity, so I apologize for that. And again, the first set of tables are the fees and expenses. The second table are the outcomes, contributions that we've paid, distributions that we've received, and the return characteristics there. So as I mentioned, I think it would be too detailed to go through each one of these directly, but I'll just point out three different items on each one of these. One on each of the different asset classes. So if you turn to page 4, you will notice this is the sixth throw down, Sigler Guff, Sisera Opportunities Fund. This is a fund of funds, and they had a carried interest of almost $3 million, which is a big increase. And that is mainly because they had 15 different exits or sales, successful sales in 2024. One was actually booked from the year before, and one of those sales was a secondary sale of a fund, uncharacteristically not for Sigler Guff, but in general for 100% of par. So they were able to sell a fund of theirs to another party at full value. Usually when you try to do that, you get a little discount because you've already seen how much the fund has performed and you're going like really far across the J curve, and so you're going to take a little haircut there in order to make up the difference in a little incremental value. So they've had a successful year there. So that stands in line with what we would like to see. And then if we turn to page 7, you'll see Angelo Gordon on the first row. Also had a little bit of carry up from, I think it was $8,000 the year before to around $250,000 there. And that is just their incremental and continued strength there. And if you just look at, it would be the next page. Their terms are essentially 7% preferred rate, which is the rate after which they can start earning incentive fee. So they needed to have made 7% before charging the incentive fees. So at 7.7, they're above that, and on 1.23 total value to paid-in capital and a 7% IRR, those numbers make sense.
Is there like a term of art, a magic word for when they hit that mark? It's not a hurdle, I guess. I don't know what you
It's called preferred return in this case. Generally, in the hedge fund space, it is called a hurdle. So you're looking for that. But it could be interchangeable in layman's terms.
Yep, gotcha.
In the carry, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Successful investment, so.
Yeah, celebration.
And the last item would be.
I'm sorry, can you go back to the prior slide? I looked at this last night again.
You're on page 8.
On the Stepstone Opportunities Fund, all series line, it's the last item.
Yeah.
What's in that bucket? I should probably know this, and if I had time, I would have taken a deeper dive, but is that an amalgam?
What's represented by that?
Yeah.
So what we report at the top level entity. So whenever we have a fund of funds, we're reporting at that top level. And so this is just that Stepstone layer at the top of, and then have all the underlying separately managed accounts underneath that. So that you're just seeing just the Stepstone numbers there of their management of the overall structure.
Okay. That's how I interpreted it. I just didn't know if that's what it was.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. And then the last item I would point you to is on page 9. This 10th row down, DLJ RECP Fund 6. The partnership expenses look really large at around $1.3 million. And we spoke to them, and the majority is part of due diligence and administrative costs. They had a write-off. They were pursuing a development deal in a state that has this pretty stringent, and they ended up not getting it approved. And so they ended up having essentially breakup fees with that particular deal. So that's uncharacteristic, but it makes sense. But these are the types of conversations that we will have with funds as they come across. So we do follow this real time. We do get notices when something like this happens. So it is not necessarily news to us. But when we look at an aggregate value over the year, as far as this report, we want to let you know that we do follow these conversations.
Yeah, so on that Fund 6, they also have a pretty high other expense number, $450K, it looks like, $452, I guess.
Yes.
Any idea what that is or what that might encompass?
Oh, sorry, the other expense?
Yeah, the other expense column, I guess it is.
I will have to look at that more closely, and I can revert back to you.
All right.
Before we move on to the appendices that you have requested over the years to review, are there any other questions?
Any other questions for Greg? Jerry.
One question. Aside from Senator Warren of Massachusetts, and I assume she's particularly interested in Carrie Nickerson, the real hot button for her.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily a facet of every investment firm. Of all their offerings. Singular Gov has a noteworthy carried interest item on there, but other singular funds or Gov funds we have don't have any carried interest at all. Is that just the way they organize it, or is that a benefit? It would seem to benefit them tax-wise to have it.
Yeah, I mean,
they don't have it in some.
So with all of the private investments, there's going to be some component of carried interest. Now, you might not see them earn it in a particular year. So carried interest is when we get paid, they get paid. That's kind of the deal. So when they get good exits and they've met their preferred return, they get carried interest. So I view carried interest as a win, because that means we have gotten our money back. We have met our rate of return that we expected, and everything's good. The green shoots I mentioned across some of these asset classes this year, we're looking back at calendar year 2024. So you look across real estate, you're not seeing carried interest. Real estate hasn't had the exits yet. Private equity's got some. But, you know, I think anytime you have a limited partnership structure, there is almost always a carried interest element, and it's up to them to earn it. So if they haven't returned our money, if they haven't returned our preferred return, they're not going to get the carried interest. So.
And the advantage is, I understand, the tax on which it takes for them is it's currently taxed at a lower rate.
Yeah, that's what gets a lot of the political attention and the media attention. I think the reality is it is an alignment of interest where, you know, they're not as focused just on managing the pool of capital. They're very focused on can we get to into the carried interest because that's where they make their real money.
Right.
Yeah. And if that was taxed at a different rate, I don't think it would change behavior an awful lot. But
yeah. It certainly seems to be a bright shiny object for some of the legislature.
Yes.
Some of the Congress.
Yes.
Great. So with that, we can move on to the third and final item, which is looking at the items the board has requested over the years. One is trends of management fees paid and carry paid. And pages 12 and 13 will have information on that in dollar terms. So this is just 12. And it's color-coded by asset class, private debt, real estate, real assets, which now would include infrastructure, as well as private equity. So the top chart here is dollar terms and management fees across those different asset classes. And the bottom chart is the carry itself. And all of these are in millions of dollars. And yes, you will notice that there is a decrease in carry in 2023, and we did discuss this last year, but it's essentially a vintage year effect of when those companies, when those firms had started investing, they hadn't had enough time to make a lot of money, right? With COVID, they started losing not having as many successful exits. And so that picks up, there's a lag in when that carry gets paid.
That's an interesting effect because 21 and 2 are far more robust.
Because, again, because of the lagging effect, you would have had those sales already in effect, so you would have paid those in those years, yeah. And then the next page, I put those in percentage terms. Both management fee and carry paid as percent of total value. Now, in this case, total value is not the total value of the SARA total plan fund. It's the total value of all the private assets, which is the summation of the distributions that we have received already, plus the unrealized value that the managers think those companies will still have or those assets will still have. That's why the percentages are on such a small scale there. So these are the trends. Again, each clump is per year, and the coloration should be the same as in the previous slides for private debt, real estate, real assets, private equity, as well as the total aggregation of all of them.
I suppose I could ask AI, or we could ask AI, or somebody would ask an AI function to do this. But does someone aggregate all of this data and then try to figure out a way to present it so that you can figure out where you stack up on the fee, you know, on the big fee chart, right? Is there somebody publishing
big
that
fee
data
chart compared to other LPs or
yes? Other investors, right? We're investors in funds, right? And varying degrees of different types. And I'm just curious if there was some sort of, you know, it's like we're measuring ourselves against benchmarks all the time, right? And I'm just wondering if there's like a master fee chart, right?
You know, somewhere. The challenge and the beauty of the private markets industries is sometimes in the opaqueness. The big databases that exist because of public records requests to organizations like us. So those big data sets basically represent what public funds pay because we're the only ones who have to turn over some of our records. So they're incomplete. But we can, I'm certain that StepStone has an AI effort to go do some of that, and that's a great question for them in 2 weeks.
Yeah, we'll put that on the docket for the 30. I was just curious if there was some type of publication.
It's been a persistent challenge to get apples to apples comparisons. Greg mentioned that we use the ILPA template. This is a partnership that we're part of, along with a lot of other pension funds and endowment funds and the sort, to try to bring more uniformity to the industry. That effort is 15 years in process, and we've made a headway, but it's never going to be as transparent as the long only market and mutual funds that have, yeah, you know, a regulatory requirement for everybody to post fees in the same way. So we do the best we can. We rely on what data we do have, and then we rely on StepStone for some benchmarking as well.
Yep, appreciate that. Thank you.
Great. And then the last item was regarding to, this was a question posed last year, as far as adhering to the contract, are the fees that we're actually paying commensurate with what we signed up for? And so going across all the different funds, again, private equity, private credit, and real estate, I just basically wrote down what the management fee was in relation to commitment, and I'll put a caveat in a second, but then the last line is it in line with what we signed up for? And across all the different funds, the answer is yes. And the caveat here is the numbers are kind of all over the place. They're not necessarily round or perfect, like 1% or 1.5 on management fees, for example. And that's because the management fees do change. There's a commitment period, and then once the fund starts investing, you start getting a different management fee on what they actually invest. And the exact formulas might be different per fund and the exact definition of what they're actually charging. So this is just a simple calculation of management fees versus what we committed to. But if we really drill down on anything, that's like the very first one is Adam Street Partners, 0.21%. That seems like a low amount. But if you look through a fund. Sorry? Oh, sorry. This would be the first one. Yeah.
So I guess in theory, you could model every, if you had the, I realize there are myriad contracts here, you could model all these and then try to track them, right, per, yes, for what the fees are, where they increase or where they change one way or the other. But it seems like a fairly, even with the magic of our friends in the AI biz, it seems like an arduous task.
Right. So, for example, if let's say we look at EQT10, which is so right after Bay Area, right? It says the commitment is 100, and the management fee is 1.5%. Well, that's the exact contract because they're still in the commitment. Sorry.
This page?
No, it's on this page.
No, it's still on this page. Page 14, right? 1, 2, 3,
EQTX,
okay, EQTX, yeah. 10.
So if you take 100 million times 1.5%, you should be able to calculate what that is.
Yeah. So that is the calculation, right?
Even I can do.
I did the management fee divided by the commitment, right? Yeah. So that's an exact number of 1.5.
Yeah.
But if you look up a couple of lines up to AE Industrial, it's 1.12. That's not our contractual number, but it's under what we do, but that's because they're also in their investment period already. So
let's clarify. It is our contractual fee, What you don't see is the 1.5% because now they're into the invested period and you're not calculating on the commitment amount, you're calculating on the invested capital. So it is still what we contracted for, but you'll see these vary as the kind of as you go from however much you committed to once you're out of the investment period, it's however much they invested. So that's what's going on there.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. You could potentially theoretically model this stuff, but it just seems arduous. But from a compliance standpoint, if you think like you're getting overcharged, I guess just to cut to the chase, if there was a situation where you felt like the fees are out of line with what you signed up for, then you have to do like an audit, right? You have to audit the contract.
Yeah, and let's be clear. This is not an audit. This is a quick and dirty, are these numbers making sense here?
Understood.
We do rely on third-party audits of all the private funds, and we get into that detail when we see those third-party audits. But this is meant to be the heuristic thumb in the wind. Do we see any outliers here? And the answer is no.
Yes, so that concludes what I have prepared for the fee report. Okay. If there are any questions beyond this, let me know.
Any other questions for Greg? I'm sure you're going to tell Brian he needs to be here next time, right?
He'll be here on the 3rd.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay.